I think that's enough on the first division fighting up there. I've described the degree of the casualties and all. We had to extend and take over another French division's front, so we had a two French division front, because we were very much larger than a French division at the time of the great German offensive. And we had quite exciting times then. I remember Roosevelt was worried about the French retiring on his right, and he got put on a little precipitate counterattack right into the French zone. I know that Debeney had directed that not a foot of ground be given up, and they had a meeting. I had gone to all the previous meetings, but General Bullard went to this one, and he was congratulated because Debeney told him that the French divisions on the front were the only ones that carried out his. The American division was the only one that carried out his order, and it stood pat. I remember I had them organize all the men with the trains, drivers, everything of that sort, Signal Corps men that were not in actual use, and we made up two scratch battalions, and one was put in charge of the adjutant, and one was put in charge of the judge advocate. And the adjutant and the judge advocate came up to my office, and my assistant was giving them their instructions. And out of the window, this valley was right in front of us, and there was a railroad running down the valley. And they wanted to know specifically just what their orders were exactly. He took them to the window, and he said, "You see the valley there? Yes. And you see the railroad along there? Yes. Well," he said, "you're to die east of the railroad. That's all the order you need." Well, there was a little bit of a chocolate twist to it, but it was a fact. That's what we wanted to do. If they're going to die, die east of that railroad. We couldn't give up any more ground. I've already commented on the opera. I was not in Paris during the meetings of the peace conference. I've described how well I knew France. My knowledge of French was, as to military French, I knew pretty well. And I learned most of it, seemed to me, in one day when I had to represent the 1st Division when they were talking of organizing a counterattack in this desperate situation during the German offensive. And apparently, the 1st Division was largely going to make it alone. And I was insisting that if the 1st went forward, there had to be a French division on either flank. And we were having a great tussle there. And I had to understand. I couldn't fail to understand, because the whole affairs of the 1st Division depended on it. It seemed to me when I came out of that, I'd never been more tired, but I learned more French under the pressure at that time than I did in previous months. My military French was pretty good. I found the casual French speaker was untrustworthy on military French, because I knew more about the exact meaning and terminology than he did. Salon French, I didn't know at all. I knew Jean fairly well, Vagant quite well, Nivelle, not at all, till after the war. Clemenceau, very well, because when he first came to the division in the August 1917, he was not prime minister. He was about to be prime minister, and he knew it. And he insisted that the Americans must get into the action right away. They must shed blood. And he made an impassioned speech there. Well, General Seibert couldn't do this. This was General Pershing's decision. It was very difficult for General Seibert, but I was present during this interview and did some of the talking in connection with it, because we were not at all trained for action, just really recruits yet, and yet the situation was desperate. Later on, I came to know him in a better way. I had gone out one afternoon with a French liaison officer, the son of the great art dealer, and afterwards ran the great arms art store that was on the Rue Royale and on the Fifth Avenue, New York, Seligman. And we were sitting on a hillside. It was a sunny afternoon. We'd visited a number of batteries and a number of other positions up on the front. And I noticed these heavy explosions here and there trench mortar bombs, and they were scattered about a great deal. We sat there and watched it for a while, and I asked Salian what that meant, that indiscriminate firing like that. And he looked at it a while. He said, I tell you what I think they're doing. I think they're registering preparatory to shooting. They're registering. And so we sat there longer and watched just what they did and charted ourselves every place that they struck. And then we went back to the front again and went along and talked to the regimental commanders to see what data they had. And they had some, but they hadn't noticed this thing very much because we had had an overall view of it all from this high hill. Well, we came to the conclusion there was one place not far from Seyspray, this valley of Seyspray there, where the line stuck out quite a ways, right on the edge of a woods. That's where that seemed to be the center of the registration. So I prepared an order that the platoon commanders in that section there should vacate that advanced position at dusk and should not occupy it till daylight. And that certain artillery units should be prepared to fire on that area in case of any trouble at night, in case of a French general bombardment. Sure enough, just at dawn the next morning, the Germans attacked. Well, it was too bad that one platoon commander was so uncomfortable outside and was cold that he took his platoon back in and met the raiders head on. And he lost, I think it was 10 prisoners. The other platoon commanders carried out the orders absolutely, and they just shot up these raiders, and we captured German prisoners, and it's seldom ever that a raid is stopped because you don't know when it's going to happen. And they concentrate all forward artillery and everything, and then pull it, and then there you are in the dark. But in this case, they're ready for them, and they shot them up very badly and took German prisoners, which is quite unusual under circumstances, and defeated the raid entirely, except for the loss of these few men, by this platoon commander disobeying his orders and coming back into position at dawn, which is exactly the time the raid is carried out. Of course, he was killed, so you couldn't say very much about it. Tommaso was now prime minister. Well, this was a great astonishment to the French, because, as I say, a raid, you're almost doomed to surprise. Here's the whole front of hundreds of miles, and some one point to pick out for a raid. You don't know that because they used all the efforts and secrecy that possibly could. And here, the Americans had met the first raid and won really a victory. We'd captured their flame fighters. We'd captured their... we captured their... I think they brought up even a gun, a 47-millimeter gun or something like that. But we captured a lot of them. We took a number of prisoners. We killed a great many. And it was altogether an American victory. Well, that was so unexpected, and contrary to all the French assumptions about our troops, they'd seen so many untrained troops, that Clemenceau himself came from Paris and came right up there, and I escorted him. And he came up, and he was giving Croix de Guerre. And he's a very old man and in doubtful health. But fortunately, he had on rubber overshoes. He gave these Croix de Guerre, but there was one fellow he didn't get. And as we were coming out, and it was very difficult because we had to walk beside the trucks, and there was only about a foot width of path along beside the trucks, this fellow came loping down the road, and he was yelling, "Wait for me, wait for me." And he caught up. He was about 6'2", and gangling, and of course covered with mud, and he'd been through the raid, and he'd done a very good stunt. He'd taken several prisoners. And Clemenceau had the medal for him. We had the name. And he just yelling and yelling. Clemenceau understood a little English. And when the fellow came up, we stood there beside the trucks, having a very hard time finding any place to stand. And Clemenceau put this on him and shook his hand. He said, "You called, you were late this morning. Well, now yesterday is what counted, and you weren't late yesterday." And congratulated him. Well, it was very interesting that the Prime Minister should come from Paris the next morning and give these Croix de Guerre, because it was quite a contrast to what they had expected of Americans because of the number of untrained troops that they had met. And untrained troops over there got into terrible situations invariably.
Wasn't he sometimes called the tiger?
Yeah. And I saw him after that a number of times. Didn't I mention the men I knew, generals, or not?
No, sir.
I mentioned my knowledge of French.
Yes, sir. Did that.
Of those French generals you met, I knew Joffre fairly well. Or I should say Foch. I knew Joffre also. Vagon I came to know pretty well. Nivelle I never saw. Clemenceau I've just described. Briand I didn't know at all. There were several French corps commanders that I knew very intimately. And I'm sorry I can't remember the names now. One of them was a famous fighter. And I knew some of the brigadiers very well. I know when we were having, when I was received the Corps de Guerre in the plaza at Metz, poor old, who's the French general? Well, the French general that was tried afterwards, imprisoned. I was very fond of him. I came to know him very, very well.
Pétain?
Huh?
Pétain?
Yeah, Pétain.
Pétain.
He entertained us all at lunch in the German commander's villa there. The German commander had a long room with, covered with deer heads and boar heads and everything of that sort. And we all assembled there. And the two brigadiers, brigade commanders of the Moroccan division, it had brigades. The others only had three regiments. It had brigades. The two division commanders were the brigade commanders were there, and I knew them quite well from my experience up there with them at Verdun, and meeting them later on when they had terrific casualties on the British Fifth Army front. They came up and greeted me, and we were delighted to see each other, and we embraced and we kissed and went through all the procedures of a French welcome, and one fellow stood with his arm around me, and I had my arm around him, and we were having quite a time. We'd had a lot to drink. And Pétain came up, said, "I'm very glad to see you on such intimate terms with my fighting generals." I told him where I'd been with them, and that I value their friendship. I value their recognition very, very much. And we had quite a time, and Pétain was talking there. Then General Pershing came up and interrupted, said, "General Pétain, I want you to meet Colonel Marshall." And Pétain said, "Well, I already know him well. I'd seen him a number of times. I already know him well. I just saw him on very friendly terms with two of my fighting brigadiers here." Well, General Pershing said, "I want you to know him because I've asked him today, while we're out in the plaza, to be my aide. His army corps that he's chief of staff of is being demobilized, and he'll now come and join me as my aide." So Pétain congratulated me then, and I came to see him quite often, just as I did Foch. I wasn't on intimate terms at all with Foch, so I traveled with him quite a bit in this country and saw him quite often with General Pershing. He was rather resentful if I said anything when I was with General Pershing. Nobody below the grade of a full general would say anything in front of Foch in the French army, and I was talking up there, very much lower ranked to General Pershing when he was in conversation with Marshal Foch. I didn't meet many of the British leaders. In fact, I don't remember. I met a great many afterwards, formally, at dinners. I met almost every army commander, and I met Sir Douglas Haig, of course. I think I met all their army commanders. In fact, I sat one night at a dinner that Parliament gave with three of the British army commanders. I don't remember the names any too well. It could be recalled to me very quickly. I knew more of the British liaison officers, colonels. General Pershing, as top commander, operated very largely through his operational staff. That's General Box Connor, who was the head of the G3 organization, so far as fighting was concerned. And he would make a temporary headquarters at the front. And of course, for quite a long time, he commanded the First Army before it was split up into two armies. And then he began commanding the group of armies. But he would either live on his train or otherwise get disposed up on the battlefront in order to be near the fighting and continued to command. And every now and then he'd have to go clear off to Paris when some momentous meeting would occur. I had no occasion to see President Wilson. General Pershing, as a leader, always dominated any gathering where he was. And he was a tremendous driver, if necessary. A very, very kindly, likable man, off-duty status, but very stern on the duty basis. I watched more in World War II about the effect of commanders. General Pershing had several staff officers, one in particular, that did a certain amount of his planning and carried out a...
Who is it? Go ahead. Continue talking, it's all right.
And they were very, or rather the German type of man. And turn it off. To straighten myself out, one or two of his officers, and some trying to copy his style without his talents and without his prestige, were very severe, and their requirements for the troops were unduly difficult, I thought, and no complaint was tolerated. Well, I think that this did a great deal of harm, allowing a man with that state of mind, that personality, to be in a commanding position, a control position, I should put it. And I was very careful to watch out for that in World War II. If I found I was running into an officer that was sort of harassing everybody, I either relieved him or tamed him down right away. And because that was very important, that the high command be understanding. What the high command had to do, and which unfrequently they were very loath to do, was to see if his generals did their job, and not the junior officers, and not at all the men. The hard thing was to make them handle the upper crust. That was embarrassing. And the War Department, I thought, always failed in its handling of its corps commanders and high officers. If they acted up and did something, there was never any reprimand, as far as I know, private or otherwise. And I would write to the fellow in the frankest possible way and tell him exactly what is wrong with him, and I would tell him that this letter was only seen by my stenographer, who could be trusted, and it would not be put in the files. But I want him to understand exactly how I felt, and if it occurred again, I'd relieve him. And that happened. Oh, I wrote three or four letters like that to the highest, very high commanders. And as long as it was quiet, you might say if you were in the regiment, as long as you didn't tell your wife and the adjutant, you could do most anything, and they would accept it. What they couldn't tolerate was the thing being discussed around. So I found most of the men that I dealt with very harshly, very arbitrarily, I should say, became my very close friends afterwards. When you asked me to recite the lessons I learned from the French that influenced me, why, it was a continual series of lessons. Most of them, what to do, and quite a number, what not to do. I learned the technique of high command, the technique of logistics, the technique of a great many of those things, and I saw troops under various conditions. I saw their regard for them in many ways that were an education to me. And I saw so many of the things they did wouldn't have worked with American troops at all. That was all very, very helpful. I would find myself leaning on that knowledge in dealing with things in the World War II. The big thing I learned in World War II was the urgent necessity of frequent visits. Well, as I used a plane all the time, and about every other week I'd go on the road before we got into the general war, I would visit most of the places in the United States with fair frequency. I know when I went out to Fort Sill the first time, I found out it was the first time the chief of staff had ever been there in the history of the place. I was there time after time, but I could move quickly, and I could act quickly, and I was abreast of what was going on all over the place. I could sense their reactions, and I could see the how they felt urgently about this or that, which we at headquarters didn't really feel so much. But I would come to an understanding in those ways, and I could correct things almost instantly, particularly after Congress, without my request, placed first $25 million and then $100 million at my disposal with no accounting required. Most of this, however, was used for underwriting, you might say. When something came up we thought we ought to do, it would take months to go through the ordinary channels to get it, through the hearings in Congress and the budget and everything of that sort. But with this money, I could put up the first $10 million, you say, or the first $20 million, and get the work all started right away. And then we'd, when the appropriation got through, we'd get that refunded from the funds that were allotted for that purpose. I couldn't recite the lessons, they were just without number. I had observation of a number of high commanders. I saw General Summerall, who was really the Iron Man. He was the nearest approach to the Jackson type that I saw in the war, and he was a wonder to watch when the fighting was on as a leader. His influence on the men was tremendous, and my admiration for him was very, very great. I thought as chief of staff he was a failure, because he didn't fit into that, and he was sort of suspicious of this or that, and he had people that were exciting his suspicions, you might say. He and I got along very intimately throughout, though he was antagonistic at the last towards General Pershing, and General Pershing was antagonistic towards him, and it was all the fault of their followers. But as a commander, he was superb. I never saw anything to beat him on the battlefield. I remember once he took a British division commander around the division. This man was going to relieve him, and Summerall took him on an inspection trip, and when he got through walking around and talking like a cathedral, as he did, with his cane, and the shells breaking all over the place, this Britisher, who was accustomed to pretty hard fighting, he came back, he said he had enough of that, he never wanted to make another inspection of General Summerall. General Summerall was really unconscious of any feeling of fear. Somebody called his attention one day in that fighting up at Exermont, the shells were just skipping their heads and coming back in just showers. Well, he said, you mustn't feel that way about it. He says, every shell that comes here is one less over our devoted infantry. At the time of General Pershing's problem of maybe going on to Verdun, one of the great troubles was the transport. The horses were all gone, largely. And when they started the march into Germany, I had to unhorse brigade after brigade of artillery and leave them on foot near the railheads and take their horses for the units that were going into Germany. We were very hard put in those respects. And if the battle had been carried on into Berlin, I don't know how it would have folded up. Of course, there was this to be said. The Germans need to be licked well, so they would not get back as really they did, marching back ostensibly in triumph, which of course was all hocus pocus. 23, as to the surrender terms, no. Yes, I was in Germany during the occupation period. Well, Fraser Hunt knows a lot more than I do. I don't recall enough of this incident about the 42nd Division to comment, but that was going on in fact every division, and always with a very deep feeling on the part of the divisional people. And I just don't recall what happened there. It didn't make enough impression on me. But as for General Pershing influencing General Connor on account of this and General Connor influencing me on account of that, that's nonsense. Most of these troubles of that kind came from the staff. I saw that so many times. And I'm happy to say that the staff I had around me never tried anything of that kind. And if I would lose my temper privately there about somebody in the field, General Hull in particular and others would tame me down and not persuade me not to send any message or anything of that sort, and I would cool off and decide in the end it's very much better not to do it, though I felt that the way they were handling the thing was very much out of place. I always felt that General Stilwell had a very hard time in China because his he talked in front of his staff, and his staff reflected his coloration, and that antagonized the British, and of course antagonized the Generalissimo. I would say this in regard to all this being written about my being hostile to General MacArthur. In the first place, it's damn nonsense. I did everything in the world I could for him, and with the Assistant Secretary of War, who I had a letter from yesterday and forgotten his name today, now the chairman of the Chase National Bank, McCoy.
McCoy.
With McCoy, we worked terribly hard, and it was a hard job to do, to have MacArthur put in command in Japan, because the Navy wanted to control that, and they put up quite a battle to get it. And we managed to control it from MacArthur. All these things were too much feeling expressed by the staff. And a lot of that comes from the general talking in front of the staff. I don't think I ever said an adverse word about General MacArthur in front of the staff, though he was very difficult, very, very difficult at times, particularly when he was on a political procedure basis. I don't ever recall saying a word in front of the staff, and I do recall suppressing them. I wrote his citation for the Medal of Honor to see that he got it, and I'll tell this now. The British, the New Zealanders, and the Australians knew nothing about his getting out of the Philippines, and we didn't dare leak it in any way. It had to be a success before we really could decide about it. And they had proposed a certain man to be the commander there, an American. I'm not going into that, who he was, but anyway, they proposed a certain man. I didn't answer because I was waiting for the work this thing out of getting General MacArthur out of Corregidor. But when MacArthur landed in that desert country of central Australia, and we got the word, I got the word, confidentially, privately, that same morning early, before my breakfast, as I recall, I called up by telephone the Prime Minister of Australia and the Prime Minister of New Zealand, because what I did was I released a news thing immediately when the word of his landing in Australia came, and saying that he was coming back to take command of the troops in that region, be the Allied commander. Well, as a matter of fact, there was no agreement for him to be the Allied commander by the Australians or the New Zealanders. They had proposed another man because they didn't know MacArthur was coming out. So as I recall, before breakfast, I called both of them up, got them on the phone, and explained why I had made this news release that he would be the Allied commander, because he would be our proposal for it, and I wanted to do it instantly so that the Japanese couldn't say that he'd deserted his command. And the same thing was in connection with his award of the Medal of Honor. I wanted to do anything I could to prevent them saying anything about his leaving Corregidor with these troops all out there in this perilous position. And I thought a Medal of Honor would be helpful, so I communicated with them, his Chief of Staff, Sutherland. As I recall, Sutherland came back to me and asked me to draft it. And I drafted the citation for MacArthur's Medal of Honor, and I remember Mr. Stimson paid me a compliment. He didn't know I had done it at first, and he said, to do a little personal bragging, which I must be pardoned, he said, well, this is very well done. Well, I said, I did it, and he took it right to the President, and the President okayed it. All these things were staff stuff. And if the commander himself was of a suspicious nature, and MacArthur was very much so, he thought we were playing him down the river all the time, which we were not at all, it made it very, very difficult. It was very hard at first because we could give him literally nothing. We weren't in quanta production. We didn't have hardly anything to send to Europe. We had a campaign going on in Africa, and we just couldn't give him anything. And Sutherland had come over, his chief of staff, to see me, to see what they might get. And I was forced into the embarrassing position of really giving him nothing. It wasn't until August, it wasn't until August before Pearl Harbor that we began to get anything in any quantity. And then we immediately started to send these things to the Philippines.
41.
41. What we could do, we did do. And it was a very trying thing for him because he just had nothing. He just had nothing. And another thing was that I found out during the course of affairs that the initial airmen that were sent him were not up to standard at all. And I picked out the man that he was very fond of and who did great things out there, Mac something or other. I've forgotten his name. And he was the first very good one that he got, and he was splendid. No, I never shared the view that the United States troops won the war for the British and the French. Won the war for the French, all right. But the British endured, fought it alone with great heroism and great persistence and endured terrible hardships and terrible casualties. And I tried to make that plain in my final report. And I think if you consult that, you'll find that I do that, and I pay a tribute to the Russians, which was not just a paper tribute, it was a fact. Their fighting was a tremendous, tremendous factor in the eventual victory. We came in time. Our arrival was determining, but the great fight was made before we were even ready. We were the victims of unpreparedness. We were not on the too late and too little basis because I went in for enough stuff so that we really had it when it began to come. And I remember I was being severely criticized by a certain congressman who were starting on the economy hunt because I had too much of this and too much of that. And I had the committee call me up. A friend on the committee asked that I didn't want to go up myself on my own initiative. And I went up on this request to answer this specific charge. And I said, well, that delighted my soul. That was the first time that I knew of in American history where American troops in the field had too much of anything. And I was very, very happy that I was responsible. And they shut up then and didn't make any more criticisms. I didn't visit those places in 44 and 45. I was at Verdun. I was in the air over those fronts. In fact, my most perilous fight was with Bradley from Verdun up to a place up in Holland, which was only about 5 minutes' flight from the German lines, and I've forgotten the name of it. It was Montgomery's headquarters. I went over many of them. I visited divisions from Switzerland clear up to Holland just before the Battle of the Bulge. I had no particular views about the Supreme Commander in 1918. I thought they ought to have a Supreme Commander. How they were going to compose their various difficulties, I don't know. Fortunately, General Pershing, who didn't have much in the way of troops ready at that time, came out in a very generous disposition. But it's very difficult, very, very difficult to manage a thing like this. And without Churchill and his tremendous influence with the British Parliament, we would have had a very hard time during the war and later on. The Supreme Commander at the start was not a very good thing. I was opposed to our taking it right at the start, and they didn't take it while I was Secretary of War. I thought that it hadn't been clarified enough. The fellow didn't have enough power, and he would just be the goat, as it were. Poor old Montgomery took it, and I thought did very well in gradually getting the thing worked out. It was quite a while before I was on the side of having an American. And I did this in paragraph 27 of page 11, commenting on the trip on the Leviathan and the parade in New York and our staying at the Willard Hotel. There were a number of triumphal parades, first in Paris, which I think I referred to, then one in London, where I know I had a devil of a horse. Inspector General picked the horse out because of his appearance, and he was a bad actor, and he couldn't manage him, and I took it over from him, and I had a terrible ride. And he went over backwards in that small Admiralty Arch, I think they call it, and broke a bone in my hand. I got one hand on him as it came down. But I was able to finish. But I was a very grateful person when I got by the reviewing stand and then went in the stand and sat in the rear row, and the General Pershing and the King and the Queen were in the front row with all the great leaders. That is, all the great citizen leaders, because all the troop leaders were in the parade. Then again, I was in the parade in New York, and then the final parade in Washington. The crowd's a funny thing, and yet very natural. Here was this great parade. We cured the defect of the New York parade, which was too much strung out, and massed the troops in Washington so that they came by in masses, and of course the parade took about a third as long and was much more impressive. But the people who were most impressed of all was the one mule licking the soup that was coming out the back of a rolling kitchen. I think that took more attention than anything else in the parade.
Well, wasn't there a parade in Philadelphia?
Not a great parade. It was a smaller parade. The trip up to Brandreth, Fox Connor's family's camp, was very, very agreeable. We stayed a month there. I'd sit up till about midnight every night going over the congressional hearings with General Pershing in preparation for his hearing. And then I sat with him doing his hearing. I have a recollection of the fight over the Versailles Treaty, and I myself had no stand in it. My view of the thing, of course, was that they could have compromised it and still had the main effect of the treaty by very slight modifications. But I thought the president was too rigid, and the others were too bitter. And his rigidity didn't go very well with their bitterness. I heard the debate one morning, but that was all. I wouldn't express any views on the League of Nations because I was not a deep student of it at the time. The general idea of it appealed to me. My views crystallized later on when it became a matter of deep concern to me in my business. I won't express any feelings about Mr. Wilson. I was too far from him. I knew his chief of staff. I knew, not his chief of staff, his secretary of state. There were two of them that I knew. And Lansing was one of them, fell out with him. And then the other one I've forgotten, New Yorker. I just knew him. I knew his family better than I did him. I knew some of the others. I knew Mr. Hoover, who really didn't say anything at all. So I couldn't know him at all. In fact, when he was Secretary of Commerce, I traveled with him on the Harding funeral train. He used to sit in the observation car for hours. And he rarely ever said anything at all. I'd rather not go into the Pershing March feud. They had it out. And I'm not an umpire of such things. I leave that to the columnists. I don't know if there was any particular thing involved in the fight over the reorganization of the War Department. One wanted one way and one wanted the other way, and the men that were already in positions wanted the more or less the original way, and the men General Pershing was going to put in the main positions wanted the other way, and it was worked out the other way. That's all it was to that. My role in the fight was largely keeping in touch with the various ones of General Pershing's probable staff, and making certain that I didn't get tied up in some of these staff jobs that I didn't want them. I would prefer that you do not pass on anything to the young man that's writing up about the March Pershing feud. I don't want to figure in that in a star position. There are too damn many feuds. History is the more important thing. I thought General March was a great administrator and a very arbitrary, tactless man. I think his greatest error was having around him a number of men that copied his type. He needed exactly the opposite type as his principal functionaries, it seemed to me. The trip of General Pershing to up to the VMI was very interesting and delighted them up there. I insisted on his going there because he'd gone to West Point and there were so many VMI men in lead positions in the Army, not so much as in the Second World War, but in that World War. I might pause to say in the Second World War, at one time we had the Chief of Staff, the Deputy Chief of Staff, the Secretary of the General Staff, I don't know how many division commanders, corps commanders, and things of that sort. And that when the Deputy Chief of Staff was made Deputy Chief of Staff, I didn't even know he was a VMI man. When the Secretary of the General Staff, Frank McCarthy, came in, I didn't bring him there at all. Another officer brought him in as an intelligence reserve officer, and he was brought down to be an assistant secretary by still another officer, and I didn't know anything about him until after he became secretary. The thing got so numerous there of VMI men that I called for the president of the Alumni Association and requested him personally for them not to make any point of it at all, because no one would believe that it hadn't been done of purpose by me because I was a VMI man. And actually, it was not that at all. Way early in the game, when we had the Army-Navy board, we had one meeting which three out of the four Army fellows were all VMI men. I didn't know it at the time. I knew I was, of course. And as we were leaving the meeting, the Chief of the Air Corps commented on the fact that it was rather unusual that three out of the four should be from the VMI. That's the first time I knew it. I was very anxious that the alumni have nothing to say about this in the way of tooting it up, because I would be the sufferer for that, because everyone would believe that I did it purely because of my VMI affiliations. As a matter of fact, I didn't know one of these men at the time they were made, and I didn't bring any of them into the War Department or near the Chief of Staff, Deputy Chief of Staff's job or the Secretary's job. The trip up to Lexington, as I say, was very interesting. The thing I mostly remembered was trying to find a certain place where the Corps deployed in the Battle of Newmarket. I wasn't making very much headway about it. I'd forgotten entirely where the place was, and I was looking for a hill slope, and actually it doesn't look like a hill slope when you get to it. And I asked this old, gaunt, bearded farmer who was back raking in the barnyard if he knew anything about the circumstances of the battle. He said yes, he seed the Corps marched right by on the hill there when he was a very young man. Well, I said, I have General Pershing out there, the commander-in-chief in France, and we're trying to find the actual battle site, and he didn't offer me any information. And I repeated again, I've got General Pershing out there in the car, the commander-in-chief of the American Expeditionary Forces, and he's going up the VMI, and I'm trying to show him the battlefield. And he didn't say anything, and I looked at him. He said, I heard you the first time. That's all we got out of him.
Well, you answered that one, didn't you, General?
I think I did. I forgot what I said. Regarding myself as a Virginian, this is by general reference. I didn't do it. My family are Kentucky, and I myself was the only member of the family born up north, and I was born in Pennsylvania, and then I went about my business, and that's about the end of that. I married two Virginians, very ardent Virginians, and I went to school in a very ardent historical Virginia section school, and I have many, 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 many friends that are Virginians. And I might say also that I pay taxes in Virginia, and I know all about that. The report of the First Army and of G3 was written by Drum and revised by me to suit General Pershing's criticisms of the original report. It took quite a long time to do it because there were so many compromises involved. All the maps and everything with the First Army report were prepared at Leavenworth under Drum's supervision. In 1923, where you say that General Pershing and I were the official escort for the Harding funeral, that's not so at all. His train that took his party up to Alaska or took them up to where they embarked for Alaska, and brought him back to California, where he died at the Palace Hotel in San Francisco, was used for the trip, and his own staff and own people and others brought on at the time. The Attorney General, who afterwards had a hard time being tried, and others that came and joined them in San Francisco. The car General Pershing traveled in was hitched onto his train, and that's the way General Pershing and I came into it. I have commented on General Pershing and his method of doing business, and the proposition of working with him, and I have mentioned his friends like Dawes and others that he was very intimate with, particularly Dawes, who I came to know very intimately myself. But I don't think there's anything for me to give other than I have given to explain how General Pershing worked. I might accentuate the fact that he was very delightful to go along with when we weren't working. He was almost boyish in his reactions, and we would have a very pleasant time. And the minute we came to work, then he was the serious-minded, you might say implacable, executive. I don't know about the citizen soldier. I was deeply interested in it, and John Palmer, General John Palmer, was immersed in it and wrote a book about it. And he was a very deep friend of mine, and I had him made an aide to General Pershing so he could bring that special knowledge of his to General Pershing's attention. Altogether, we were in a period there where it was rather formative of the new Army organization, and it is very important that the citizen-soldier aspect be most carefully considered. And it was, and we made, I think, considerable progress in it. The trouble was there were those that little-minded, that didn't understand much about the main thing, and they just cherished their own griefs and their own prejudices, and that was so on both sides. And you've got to work against that all the time. I think early in General Pershing's period of return from France, some of his friends deluded him into this presidential aspect. I know one group came up from Tennessee, and I sent him back home, and he was away at the time, and he was furious with me. I didn't even consult him. But I knew pretty well what the general reactions were, and I thought it was a shame that he might in some way cut down his prestige by being involved in that sort of a thing, unless it was almost by acclamation. I was somewhat acquainted in the distance with General Wood's efforts. He was very highly regarded by many. I think he did raise the standards of the Army by his insistence on type of discipline. Very naturally would, and he was a very imposing, impressive man. I don't think I insisted, learned from him the spit and polish part. I knew how to do that long before I ever saw him. It has a decided place, and is pretty much evidence of the general state of discipline of the command. The point is, when it's overdone, of course, it's harmful. As anything is a rule, it's harmful. And that would be particularly harmful if it took a lot of time from the other training. The trouble with the other training is that not a tremendous number had the imagination and everything to make it interesting and to intrigue this soldier. And it was very difficult to do it because it required so much of movement, so much of territory, so much of expense, all of which was, matter of fact, they leaned against in time of peace. When I was called in by General Craig and made Deputy Chief of Staff, I used to go over all the papers. He'd sit in, just listen in. The Secretary of the General Staff and others would bring up for various decisions. And we'd spend more damn time over the right to run a road or run a sewer line or something else across a reservation than we would on all the bases for training for the summer camps. And it was the minute you got into that training of that sort, you were pushed out by the money factor pretty quickly, and you had to have so much ground, you had to do so much maneuvering to get it done. And unless they were all intent on that, and instead of being distracted by all these other things, it was very difficult to handle it. I was intent on it, and I made myself very unpopular. I've given enough incidents of General Pershing, I think, for the purpose. I don't care to go into any more of these things. I think I've done enough on that. And I'm not writing a history of General Pershing. Well, I would say the severe cut in the Army strength was a tragic affair. I remember General Pershing coming back from Europe and writing me a letter, which I just happened to find when they were debating all these affairs in the outset of World War II preparations, that he'd come back to find that the total strength they were considering was 110,000. Well, we'd had 180,000 before the war began. And now it was down to 110,000, and what was more, actually it came out 118, but what was more, all the teamsters and the men around the hospitals and things of that sort that had been civilians before now were taken out of the soldierly ranks. And then the next thing is they began to draw the troops, the soldiers, from the special units in the ground troops in order to provide the men for the Air Corps. They wanted the Air Corps increased a certain way, and yet they didn't provide, they had boards to investigate it, the Congress did, and then they accepted the board report, and then they drew the men from the ground troops. So finally, we just had nobody. You couldn't even train a battalion. You didn't have any communication people. You didn't have your special platoons. I think we used to have one stage there. We had one horse as the transportation for the battalion commander. The orderly had to get off the horse apparently and walk about that time. I've forgotten just how bad it was, but it was pretty bad. And where the headquarters company was supposed to be, I think 318 men, it had gotten down to about 18. You couldn't train. They didn't have any of the normal facilities except for the individual soldier. That's about the only thing you could get at. And it was a very tragic thing because the knowledge of command and control of such units was disappearing from the Army. And I had a very severe battle over this when I first started in as Deputy Chief of Staff and later as Chief of Staff. This denuding of the Army always occurs. I have suffered from it myself. I walked into it in the First World War, the First Division, when we had nothing. I walked into it in the Second World War when I came in as Chief of Staff, and I walked into the same effect exactly when I came into the Puerto Rican thing, the Korean affair. And I'm an expert on what a dire situation it is, and it seems to be the democratic way of doing it. They'll spend billions as a result of the war, and they won't spend a million or two to prevent the war. That's just about what it amounts to. I thought the disintegration in 46 and 47 was the most amazing thing. I was out of the country most of the time in China, and I didn't realize how complete it was until I went over as Secretary of Defense, and I just found little or nothing. And you had to start clear back and begin all over again. And then, of course, all the money that was involved in that, all the lives that are lost in that, all the bad feelings and confusions that were built up out of that came into it. However, the minute you come in again, they're having a battle now, of course, with too much. Well, you've got to be careful about that and see that it's done considerably, very carefully. My feeling now, I'll say this, my feeling now is that the mistake they make is by trying to add a few or trying to trim a few, trim an appropriation down from paring this down a little and paring that down a little. My reaction now is, I don't want to go into it now, in a sense, but I will put this much into the record. My reaction now is what they should do, what is lacking, is a study of how to find an attitude of preparedness that is not going to beggar the taxpayer and is going to be able to be maintained in time of peace through a long peace. And, of course, that goes back inevitably to compulsory service. That's just one of the incidents only, but it's one of the inevitable incidents in that. But a little, about 15% of the public, which is articulate, certain fellows fighting about the enrollment at colleges, though the big universities have come in correctly on this, and other things like that, and the political things in Congress, they go right back exactly to the same thing they had in 98, the same thing they had in 1914 and 1917, the same thing they had in the Second World War, and the same thing they had in the Korean affair. There's literally no change at all. I know when I left the General Staff chief of staff. I talked to the staff, and we were differing. At that time, there was nobody, I thought it was the finest staff I'd ever seen, so far as the quality of the men is concerned, and their understanding of their war duties. But I don't think there was a single one on that staff